So what I'd like to talk today is basically to, I'm not sure how many of you were here last week on Thursday. I mean, so it's basically a continuation of the discussion that we had that Ilya led on inhomogeneity in complex materials. In this particular case, what I would like to discuss is role of inhomogeneity in superconductors and under what conditions, in fact, it can be beneficial. We all know it can be detrimental. For example, impurities can destroy superconductivity. Magnetic ones can destroy S-wave, the usual ones can destroy D-wave, etc. But the question that I would like to ask is, so is it so generic? So can inhomogeneity be ever good? So this work was done in collaboration with Daniel Podolsky, who is now postdoc at Berkeley, and with Steve Kibbleson. So here's the brief outline, although it's a 15-minute talk, it might be useful to know what to expect. So first of all, I'd like to describe the, it's a fairly simple observation, and I think last week in 5 minutes, I pretty much summarized it. But here I'd like to show you in a bit more detail how to demonstrate that in weak coupling situation, if we introduce a gentle enough inhomogeneity, in fact, we can expect it quite generically to be beneficial for TC. Not so good for superfluid stiffness, but good for TC. Then actually, also I'm going to consider the strong coupling regime on an example of attractive Hubbard model. And in fact, this case is quite a bit more tricky, and it seems that the answer seems to be a function of time. So last week I thought inhomogeneity sort of, again, enhances TC, but this week I believe the opposite. So far it's pretty binary. So I know. So I'm going to give you the arguments, and it's going to be up to you to decide how plausible it is. And so at the end, I'm going to sort of throw out some speculations and open questions. I mean, in the form of questions, because this way, I hope not to offend too many people. So, okay. So the sort of simple toy problem that I'd like to consider here is the attractive Hubbard model on the lattice. Okay. So, and just to set terminology, these are still electrons. And this is their dispersion chemical potential. And so now we have on-site attraction in between the spin-up and spin-down electrons. So compared to the usual thing, which is considered, we now allow this attraction U to be a function of space. So U can vary from site to site. Now, for uniform, we know what happens. We just get S-wave superconductivity, Q equal to zero pairing in weak coupling. And so there are not too many surprises. But now let's say that we want to consider a slightly different problem. Namely, we want to vary this U from site to site. And the simplest way to do that is to impose some harmonic modulation. So that's discordant X, and we allow U to be either small or large depending on position. Okay? And the question that we want to ask is, so what's going to happen to superconductivity in this case? So it turns out that, well, not too surprisingly, that's a simple problem. And so one thing we can do is to essentially derive again the BCS equations for instability for TC. Okay, but so now the difference with the conventional case is that so usually we know that the dominant pairing happens in the zero momentum, total momentum condensate. So Coulomb pairs are composed of k and minus k electrons. Now here, as we're going to see, in fact, there is this modulated potential imposed also coupling into different condensates with different momentum. So, yes. Sure.
So imagine I have a modulated attractive U.
Yes.
Let's go to the extreme case, and the modulation is very large.
Yes.
I think that what we should get at some point is essentially both glass. Each thing will just.
Yeah. We'll get to that. Yeah. So, but yeah, so here what I'm considering explicitly is, I'm not sure if I said that, but first is going to be the weak coupling regime. So U is actually smaller than the bandwidth. Okay, so we're not looking at this extreme localized Bose-Einstein type of regime. Yeah.
Therefore, BCS, you don't worry about phase coherence, you just worry about.
Well, we will. We will. I mean, phase coherence is still important, but we'll get to that. So first of all, what I want to do just the simplest mean field. Okay, and then we'll see. I mean, how valid it is, in which regime it's supposed to be good. Okay? So, but again, so first mean field. And at the mean field, we just have those order parameters, which are just expectation values of twice, let's say, annihilation operators. And at TC, the we can basically limit ourselves to linear equations. And the BCS instability condition is when this integral equation acquires non-trivial solution. Tiny, but non-trivial. Non-trivial means non-zero. Okay. So, and as you see, what enters here is this potential, but now, unlike the usual case of attractive Hubbards, where U is just flat constant of momentum, so here we have now two harmonics, and you can tell that this will introduce coupling between, for example, delta at zero momentum and delta at momentum U, which is the period of modulation of the potential. Okay. So now, this kernel K is just the usual thing. As always, it's this anomalous correlator, okay, two Green's functions going in the same direction. Now, usually for BCS, again, we only worry about this kernel at zero momentum, but here, in fact, we have to consider also other momentum. Okay, so, and that's roughly how it looks like. So it's, so what you're probably extremely familiar with is when P is equal to zero, I mean, when the momentum is equal to zero, then it's just log of a negative, some cutoff in principle. I put here omega d, like cutoff, but for this particular model, obviously, it's just the bandwidth. It's a few times t, I mean, little t. But just for the sake of argument, let's put explicitly a different letter for the cutoff, divided by temperature. And then this interaction is only operable for frequencies which are, or for momenta, which are in the corresponding units below the cutoff. Okay? So now, given this expression for k, actually for any expression for k, we can write down the series of equations, this chain of linear equations, which we need to solve in order to determine whether the system is superconducting, whether it wants to become superconducting or not. Okay? And so you see it's basically this tri-diagonal matrix. Very simple. So the usual BCS equation would be if we take this piece from here, a zero momentum at pairing amplitude. So interaction times the kernel, this pairing kernel, again, at zero momentum, and on the right-hand side, delta. So delta-delta cancels. And therefore, the instability condition for the uniform case is just U times K equals to 1. So we substitute, and we get the usual expression for the BCS transition temperature. Okay? So now we have this a bit more complicated situation when we have this tri-diagonal matrix. And what you realize immediately, it looks kind of like a particle in a lattice, so it can jump left and right. It's 1D. And essentially what you know for this kind of simple toy quantum mechanical problem is that if you delocalize particle, then you form a band. And in the band, there will be energies which are actually higher than this local energy, localized energy, and which are lower. And that's basically the key. You can also relate it to Frobenius-Perron theorem, but the physics, the underlying physics is just as simple as this. Your eigenvalues are going to be both larger and smaller than any particular eigenvalue. Yes?
So the statement, you say higher, which is a relative thing. So the statement I'm taking away from this is that given an inhomogeneous pairing interaction, the inhomogeneous gap will have a higher TC than the homogeneous gap.
Given inhomogeneous, yes.
I can raise TC by making my pairing interaction inhomogeneous. In other words, the higher is not relative to the case of the homogeneous pairing interaction.
It is.
It is?
Yeah. Because, so you see, this yellow equation, if you can see this yellow shadow, is basically the equation for the homogeneous pairing, homogeneous delta.
You're comparing if I just have the U0 versus if I have the U0 plus the U1.
Okay. So, sorry. I should have said that more explicitly.
You have to be careful about how you're comparing.
Exactly. So that's a good point. So what I want to compare is basically the case of uniform U, which is equal to U0, and another distribution of U's, but such that the average is still kept the same. Okay. And then later I'll try to justify why this is a reasonable assumption. So same average, but different distribution.
Okay, so the statement is for the if I just have the U0 and the uniform solution, my TC is lower than if I have the U0 plus the U1 and the inhomogeneous solution.
Yeah, okay, so in fact, the thing is that for uniform U, you can prove that the best solution is just the constant solution. I mean, so Q equal to 0 solution.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there is no further assumption there. So the real comparison is just uniform U and non-uniform U is the same average. Okay. Yeah. That's right. It will be a mix of Q equal to 0, Q equal to momentum Q, 2Q, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, yes. I mean that's a natural assumption. But so again, in the weak coupling, so all the length scales are usually quite long, right? Yeah. And so the other thing is that if your Q is too large, then essentially there is no way that this kernel is going to do anything. It can be essentially negligible. Yeah. So here I assume that well, in principle, here I didn't assume anything, but later on we'll assume this. Just it's like obviously. It's a linear analysis, so yeah, that's in principle. I mean, from the form of this matrix, you can see that although the argument might become a bit more tricky, but there is no obvious constraint on U. It doesn't need to be particularly smaller than U zero. Okay, it will become important when we talk about fluctuations, but at this point, at the mean field level, it doesn't really matter. So the statement is that at the mean field, TC goes up when we make this. We increase U somewhere, decrease U some other place. Okay, and so this is sort of the summary of the how it looks and what it means. So this is TC, and this is this modulation wave vector for the pairing interaction. Okay, so if the modulation is very fast, so the pairing interaction oscillates very quickly on the length scale of the coherence length, then essentially superconductor averages out those perturbations, and you just get old results. Okay, so that's E of the usual BCS formula for TC. But now, what we find is that if the correlation length is small compared to the variation length scale of this variation, then superconductor basically can locally take advantage of this high pairing. So at this hill, and then essentially that's at the mean field again. That's all you need in order to create a superconductor, because as soon as it's superconducting someplace, it's going to be superconducting everywhere. Yeah, this is true. At the mean field, that's... Yeah. Sure. Yeah, exactly. So that's why I said at the mean field, yeah. We'll go to the fluctuation.
If I were to compare this with proximity effect,
yeah.
You could imagine the extreme case of a superconductor in a normal metal. And then what you're doing is you're inducing superconductivity in a normal metal by hyper-pair tunneling. But I think doesn't the normal metal also degrade superconductivity?
Yeah. So we'll get to that. So at the moment, so we'll go in stages. Although I understand that I mean this is such an advanced audience that maybe I should have started at the end. But the point is that at the mean field, again, I want to emphasize, you can do in principle something like this. You have your choice, right? How to distribute your pairing interaction. I can put all of it within one angstrom, gets I don't know, 10 to 16 Kelvin transition temperature. I mean, assuming I don't have a significant cutoff on my bandwidth. And then, you know, the rest of the system will follow, because just, you know, if this little piece is superconducting by proximity, essentially the rest of the system will be superconducting. Okay. Of course, it's not such a great idea if you want to have any use of this system, because, I mean, in reality, of course, the stiffness, superfluid stiffness, is going to be essentially zero everywhere. But as a matter of principle, again, at the mean field level, that's what I would find. Okay. So, but as all of you noticed, of course, that's not particularly realistic. So, this regime, in fact, when I have just this tops of the mountains superconducting, and you know, the rest non-superconducting, is going to be not always the best possible idea. Okay. But again, so that's mean field. Now, one thing, just a sideline here, is that, and that was also noticed last week, that if I have this kind of modulation of potential, inherently that will also lead to modulation in the, not just in the pairing, but also not in the anomalous expectation values, but also in the potential which is acting on the electrons. Okay, and as such, it can, for example, open gaps on the Fermi surface and do many, many bad things. So the assumption which I implicitly used is that at this vector Q doesn't really match with any particularly interesting vectors corresponding to my electrons. So it doesn't gap out Fermi surface. So it's this weak effect as opposed to, for example, if I had an undoped Hubbard model with nearest neighbor hopping and I used Q equal to pi pi, of course, that would be a completely different story. Okay, so we're not considering this case. So anyway, so now we're to this proximity business. So let's say that we look in this interesting regime when modulation is very long wavelength, okay? And essentially, we want to see how the superconductor will look like in this case. And what is shown here is pretty much schematically what the solution of this gap equation will look like that I've shown to you before. So this line over here basically denotes sort of the minimal U for which I would have a superconductor, okay, at a particular, at a given temperature. Okay, so all of this pink region would be superconducting if I had a uniform system, I mean, given this value of U. And all of that region would be sort of forbidden region. It wouldn't want to be a superconductor. So then you can convince yourself that the delta will be growing actually quite rapidly within those regions if you just do the mean field. And then it will be decaying pretty much exponentially into this forbidden region. Okay, and I'll show you in next transparency roughly how you do it. But so clearly, delta is very small here. And small delta means that the stiffness is going to be small. And therefore, fluctuations have a very good chance of destroying my beautiful superconductor, which, you know, sets, I mean, global superconductor. I would still have superconducting fluctuations locally, but no global phase coherence. So I really have to take care, I mean, take into account the fluctuations. So how do we do it? So one way to do it.
The assumption you described earlier of doing equal fluctuations around the medium and then linearizing, that is not going to let you have a potential which gets close to zero.
Well,
yes.
In principle, here, what I'm going to show you now is really more generic case. So this is the Ginzburg-Landau, and so that's, again, that's just this old parent kernel, and we assume here that the electron propagators are not really affected significantly by the potential homogeneity for the reason I just described. So this is now the interesting piece. So it's this delta squared over U. And now U is basically any kind of function of coordinates. Okay. Now, in principle, you can also have coupling between the actual charge density and order parameter. And this, if somebody's interested, I can describe how this can come about. And that's the quadratic term. So that's our Ginzburg-Landau. Okay. And sort of these two-step process to proceed is the following: to analyze the effect of fluctuations. Is to first of all assume that delta is real, okay, which is exactly the same as what we do when we solve mean field. And then we take this variational derivative of free energy over delta, and we get, I always forget what the name of this equation. It's probably related to Gross-Pitayski. But anyway, it's this nonlinear equation for deltas, which is going to be second derivative of delta, then some delta terms and delta cubed terms. Okay, but the point is that it's solvable. And as a result, we get delta mean field. Okay, and we can do matching in these regions to what's happening in the forbidden region. So this is all doable. So the net result is some function of space, this delta mean field. Okay. So as I described here, what we want to allow for some phase fluctuations on top of this mean field solution. Okay. So we say that, in fact, the order parameter, the magnitude is given by this mean field, but in fact it can have this phase degree of freedom. Okay, and it can definitely destroy superconductor. So now if I take the solution and put it back into my free energy, in terms of this phase variable, that's my reduced free energy, or effective free energy.
What's the definition of Fresnel?
Yeah, so here a definition is just it's V Fermi over temperature. So maybe it's not the best letter, but yes. Okay. Yeah, so what you see is basically it's an XY model, and if we're in two dimensions, then it's two-dimensional XY model, and the stiffness is now related to the square of the order parameter. So indeed, the regions which have small delta, or even worse, exponentially small delta, will have weak stiffness, and therefore can be easily sort of twisted, rotated, and can be detrimental to superconductivity. Okay. So, okay. So it's five including questions, or? Okay, fine. So this way we'll not get to the speculative part. Nobody's going to be disappointed. So anyway, so there are a couple of curious questions, limits that we can consider. So one is when we have unidirectional modulation. And so J is, again, is a function of space in this particular form. Then you can show that the effect of J, which is going to determine the Clausewitz Salus temperature, is given by the following geometric mean of the average J and inverse of the average of inverse J. So essentially, that's pretty much like maximum J, and that's going to pick up the minimum J. So it's a trivial exercise if you basically look at two-dimensional Schroders, and you do a twist, and you want to determine what's the effect of stiffness when you coarse grain. Then across those inhomogeneities, that's the effect of stiffness that you're going to have. And along, since all the twists are going to be the same, it is the average J which enters. Okay. So that's how it works. So also, you can do a pretty curious duality trick and argue that something very similar also should apply in general random case if in the end you expect to get isotropy in two directions. Yes, J will be temperature dependent. That's right. So essentially the equation that we're going to get in the end is going to be implicit equation for the transition temperature. Yeah. Okay. So and that's the way you can treat extremely inhomogeneous case, it seems to be. And there are some expressions, but in the paper I didn't really put them here. So in fact, now, let's do the phase diagram. Again, now including the effect of fluctuations. The net result of all of that is that fluctuation is definitely going to decrease TC. Okay, the inhomogeneity is too long wavelength. Okay, of course it cannot decrease it below the sort of below the bare minimum, so that's the lower bound, and so that's the average again. And in fact, the peel off is going to start when the separation, the modulation wavelength becomes longer than the coherence length. Okay, that's when you start peeling off. And here, in fact, the two values are very close. And this really follows from the fact that if you calculate stiffness in usual BCS superconductors, it's just Fermi energy, so it's extremely high. So if the modulation is not too long wavelength, you really, this fluctuation region, KT, region below mean field, but above KT temperature is extremely tiny. So that's the general shape. So here one might argue about the speculate about the connection perhaps to cuprates, that if you go to a very non-uniform case, you get this sort of mean fieldish behavior in some range of temperatures and then KT. And when you go to sort of very, because this is roughly like uniform case, if you go to uniform, then TC goes decreased. So that's as much as it's worth. So that's the strong coupling case. I'm not sure if I want to go much into detail, but if there is a question later on, I can answer. But the essence of it is that, again, the whole thing maps onto XY model because now you have essentially electrons pairing up locally on individual sites if U is very attractive and very strong. And then to jump, you have to break the pair apart, so you get effective bandwidth like this, and you DC temperature, something like that. And again, what you want to do now is impose this inhomogeneity and see what happens to the transition temperature, which is again KT transition. So one can go through approximately cold-eighth arguments and find that in fact TC suppressed. And it is very subtle, so I don't want to spend much time on this, but if there are questions, we can discuss. So the result seems to be, so this is robust, I'm 100% sure about this. This seems to be, as I mentioned, function of time. Last week it was here, this week it's here. But it's, anyway, it's probably on average is zero. So it's a tiny effect. 8? Oh, that's infinity, actually, this way. No, 8 is bandwidth, so that's why. It's basically, that's where you have crossover from weak coupling to strong coupling. Okay? So that's the shape. That's how it looks. Anyway, but now let's just very briefly sort of contemplate what it means and why it can be interesting. So the statement that I made is that if we sort of increase bearing potential somewhere, decrease it somewhere else, then I can increase TC. And you can ask, so what? I mean, why don't I make my whole system uniformly, strongly interacting, and therefore having overall higher TC? But we know that sometimes it's not such a great idea, because as you start cranking up your coupling interaction, for example, interaction electron phonon interaction, you run into some kind of structural transition, and then you renormalize everything, and essentially you run into a problem, and you reduce effectively your pairing strength. So the question one might ask is, can one locally exceed this maximal critical pairing strength, and this way increase even globally achievable superconductivity, thereby exceeding the so-called Macmillan criterion? So then the other question of interest, I think, is if there could be some connection with stripes, because we know that stripes, again, they might sort of play along with superconductivity by creating, for example, edge modes, which are evanescent into the away from the stripes, but sort of peaked at those inhomogeneities. And these could be phonons, magnons over there, any kind of nonlinear combinations thereof. So I think that's a curious sort of direction of research. And also this topological nature, which was beaten upon for a long time, could in fact come in quite handy, because it tells you that it's not really just formation of those stripes. It's not a Fermi surface effect, but rather they are protected in some other way, and therefore they might not be so detrimental to electrons, you know, by gapping out Fermi surface, etc. And also, I think an interesting question is whether there is some connection which can be established to inhomogeneous repulsive models, which I think are very interesting. And so most recent work is by Arrigoni, Fratkin, and Kibbleson, where they showed that, again, something we discussed last week, and that if you have a repulsive Hubbard model but with inhomogeneous hoppings, so let's say large T, small t, and then you get you can prove that it's superconducting and it's pretty high TC. Okay, thank you.
Couldn't you say what the role of the coupling
would be?
Wouldn't it bring
DC
down slightly?
No, actually.
In turn, you're always on
the
alpha, delta.
Yeah. So here it is. So in fact, I mean, to linear order, you can see, since both of them are delta squared terms, you know, if this one is modulated and we know that it enhances TC, you know, you can, for example, if U1 is small, and we just look at the single Q modulation, you expand this guy, and it's going to be something times cosine over here. This guy is roughly the same. So if I modulate my density, again, in some periodic fashion, the role of this term is going to be roughly the same. I mean, you can, if your question is how you rationalize this one, I think the simplest way is to say that, for example, if your density of states is not particle Hall symmetric, so locally increasing density will increase density of states, locally decreasing density will decrease density of states. Density of states is also something which enters into this TC, into the exponent, right? Therefore, again, the same story goes through. Okay. And beryllium is superconducting?
Higher than the beryllium gold alloy.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, so I mean, it is testable in a sense. I mean, even with high TCs, if you do digital structures, I mean, in principle, the claim would be that you can do better. Yeah.
When you talk about
That's right. Yeah, so can I answer? No? Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure if such an argument exists. I mean, it would be interesting to see. But I guess, I mean, so my take on this is that, and that's why I mentioned the stripes and this topology business. So it could be, you know, in homogeneity, sort of at the most true level, could come from metallurgy, right? And so the way you prepared your sample, you have some stuff. And it's not sort of self-consistently put in. Now, also, I mean, so as we saw in the previous talk, you know, those grain boundaries, they can have, I mean, not dramatically, but enhanced TC by, say, 20 degrees out of 350. So it's quenched, yes. So it could be quenched. Now, the other possibility, which I think is a bit more interesting, because by quenching, I don't know how good you can do. But I think the more interesting possibility, if this superstructure, I mean, this long wavelength structure, is, again, it has to be extrinsic to electrons. It shouldn't be CDW or SDW, because if it is, then we know precisely. In a weak coupling, it just gaps out Fermi surfs, and there is nothing interesting that's going to happen. But again, with those stripy things, it's different, right? Because stripes are, intrinsically, they're not, say, weak coupling phenomenon. In fact, this topological nature just makes them quite well protected. Okay? Yeah. That's right. So at formally it's the same. I mean, the sort of you know, philosophically it's different.
Okay. Very strong last question.
What's the argument why leaving the kinetic energy unchanged?
Yeah, because so that was this deal. Roughly speaking, because so you do gap out parts of the Fermi surface if you have arbitrary Q, but you can estimate this effect, and it's rather small.
For Gini structure, I would think there's a lot of effect then all from inside the kinetic energy, which would become pretty bad.
Yeah. So if you have strongly homogeneous, I don't have a good argument why it should be true. I mean, so in the weak modulation case, you can show that the effect is small. And definitely it's not exponential. But for a very strong modulation, I don't have a good argument.
Okay, let's thank the speaker. Next speaker is Sitan
Wong. Hi. Yeah.
There we go. Okay, I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me a chance to talk about some of the recent work. I thought I'd stay away from high TC and the magnets for a little bit and talk about some strong electronic correlation effect and Fermi surface topology in the sodium-doped cobaltate, which is another transition metal oxide. The work is done in collaboration with Sen Zhou and Meng Gao, who are graduate students, and Hong Ding, whose photoemission experiments actually inspired this work, and also in collaboration with Patrick Lee. So since this material has not been talked about much, so I'd like to follow what we usually do in a sort of standard way to talk about the material and its electronic structure in terms of LDA calculations. And I'll ask the question, how important are correlations? And usually we go to specific heat measurements to try to answer this question. But in this particular case, I'll point out that the specific heat measurement is actually inconclusive. So it becomes very important to actually ask what exactly is the electronic structure as measured, say, by ARPES. Is it in agreement with the LDA calculations, or is at variance? In this case, we find fundamental differences, which points to the importance of electronic correlation. And in the second half of the talk, I'll just describe a theoretical approach to try to address this strong correlation physics in terms of a multi-band Hubbert model for the cobalt T2G orbitals. And I'll analyze this in both weak and strong coupling and provide a possible resolution for the emission experiment. So the material is actually simpler than any of the materials I think we've talked about so far, that the cobalt will form a triangular lattice, and it's a layered structure. The blue one is the cobalt. The oxygen octahedra is tilted away, and these are the sodium atoms. So and you can add water to this material, and what it does is expand the C-axis. That's all we know about what weather does structurally. So the phase diagram is actually quite rich. It certainly qualifies as a complex material. Here at one half of sodium concentration, you have actually a charge-ordered insulator, and this is actually a concrete example where sodium order, that is the dopant order, leads to actually an electronic state that responds to it and becomes a charge insulator. The material has been around for quite a long time because of high thermoelectric performance at around 0.7. But the interest in this material is really rejuvenated because of the 5-degree superconducting phase that is down here when you add water to the sample. So the joke I hear these days is when you go on travel, you tell the students that don't forget to water the plants, but also remember to water the sample. So,
what's the common valence of cobalt?
Yeah, I'll get to that. Yeah, I'll get to that right away. So here is just the general phase structure. And here you have a paramagnetic metal below 0.5 and a QE-wise metal above that. And recently, very recently this year, at around 0.8, the material is found to be magnetic ordered with an A-type magnetic structure. I'll go to all this. So let's just step by step. We'll start with the cobalt atom, which is a 3D orbital that's five-fold degenerate. And the octahedral field, crystal field splitting, makes that into a T2G complex and an EG. So we only need to focus here on the T2G complex because the number of electrons that we have for cobalt. It's going to be less than 6, let's say. Whereas in the high TC, we go to the EG orbitals. Now, because of the octahedral tilt, there is a trigonal field. The trigonal fields further split this T2G orbital into two that we call EG prime and the A1G orbital, which are linear combinations of these D orbitals here. Yeah. It is. This is a LDA calculation that you can do by putting in the trigonal crystal field, and the way it does is to split in this way. Yeah. Now, also in contrast to high TC, as you can see, because of octahedral tilt, now these T2G orbitals points to the midpoint of the oxygen-oxygen bond. Now, this tells us actually the direct exchange between the cobalt orbitals is important. This is in contrast to in high TC in the cuprates, where you want to form a Zahn-Wright singlet between the copper and oxygen orbitals. Yeah.
When I start populating in the Kundu.
Yeah, well, we'll get to all that. So now the next thing to do is to ask, what is the sodium doing, still at the atomic level? If X is equal to zero, here's the question of valence, then the cobalt is in the 4+ state. So we have 5 electrons, and that occupies the T2G complex in this way, right? The EG, just ignore that, it's 2.5 volts up. Now, what is sodium, in this case, in the 4+ case, the low spin state is a spin 1/2 system. So that's also very interesting. Now, if we add sodium, so we electron dope the system, and the cobalt has another valence, which is 3+, in which case you actually put 6 electrons in the T2G complex. The low spin state is spin 0. So loosely speaking, what you have here, in some sense, is a best opportunity to observe a spin liquid on a triangular lattice when it's undoped, not being observed, and just saying this is the possibility. And if you dope with sodium, electron doping, you can reach the other side at X equal to 1, which is a band insulator.
So you're saying, because the peak splitting is too large, actually, to prevent this from a high spin state.
Yeah. And another thing that's quite different than high TC is the doping range that is of interest is in this region. It's a moderate to large doping. So now if sodium doping is X, the concentration is X, you have 5+ X electrons per cobalt atom, per cobalt site. So that's sometimes, that's inconvenient. So what I'll do is I do a particle hole transformation and just talk about 1 - X holes per cobalt site. So I'll mostly use this convention. Yeah.
Would you suggest that the present neutron scattering data on the system would go hand in hand with the triangular lattice spin 1/2?
No. That's not what I'm saying.
You said there's a triangular lattice.
Right. It's a triangular lattice, so it's not likely to be nail ordered. Right. But the neutron scattering is done at 0.8, which is here, very far away from the half-filled case, and they do find ordered moments. It's very difficult. The half-filled sample is cobalt oxide, and I find it interesting that we don't even know what cobalt oxide does with great confidence. Whether it's insulator or metal is not, there's still debate. Dioxide, yeah.
The sodium pulling the sodium out, the thing actually doesn't just collapse.
It just collapses. It goes some other phase. Yeah.
There is another crystallographic.
Right.
At the point. So as you pull the sodium.
Right.
Out,
yeah. I think two groups are now trying to do that, to see if you can actually go to a mild insulating phase here. Now we put the atoms in the solid. So what happens? All these levels I'm talking about starts developing bands because the electron hops. So this is the A1. So this A1G level turns into a band. The bandwidth is larger. It's about 1.6 volt. The EG prime splits into this band, and the bandwidth is smaller. It's 1.3. Now, the band structure is here down by LDA calculation. The A1G and the 2 EG prime binds hybridize strongly. You should see, actually, if they weren't hybridizing, this A1G would be this band. So the thick line really tells you the character of the A1G. And these two are the EG prime band. So what we learn from the LDA is A1G band has a lower center of gravity, right? But larger bandwidth, right? So that's why it has, I'll get to the effects of that. So EG prime lies within A1G. The other thing is, this is a multi-band system. This is the clearest multi-band system. As you can see, the Fermi level cuts through two sheets of the two bands. So the Fermi surface topology looks like this. The A1G band give you a large Fermi surface around gamma point, and the EG prime bands give the 6 small hole pockets. And the other thing that's important is the density of states is enhanced because the presence of these pockets. As you can see here, this is the A1G density of states, this is the EG prime density of states. And so the Fermi level density of states is strongly affected by the presence of this other band. Since the band, another interesting thing is this system has such a narrow bandwidth, it's 1.6 volt. It's like cuprates, where a single band bandwidth is about 1.6 volt. But the U typical for this system is between 5 and 8 volt. So U over W, which is a measure of strong correlation, is actually quite large. And one would expect the system to be actually in the correlated regime. So we look at specific heat and see if there is a large mass enhancement. That usually is done for a material that you suspect of strongly correlating character. So in this case, it's done, and the density of states at the Fermi level is about 7 state per volt. This is from extracting from specific heat measurement. If you try to attribute all of this from a single tight banding A1G orbital, just assuming there is only one band, then you get a mass enhancement of about 6. So that seems to say, okay, this thing is probably strongly correlated, right? But however, the thing is not that that trivial, because the presence of the EG prime band, the LDA density of states at the Fermi level is about 5 state per volt. It's also quite large. And that enhancement is due to the presence of these pockets. And these pockets seem to do more wonders because they're almost perfectly nested. So they actually enhance the tendency towards charge order for the system and enhance spin fluctuations as well. And you can use these spin fluctuations to mediate a superconductor, superconductivity, and you find unconventional superconducting behavior. There are various proposals. There is the out-gap triplet S-wave. And in this other work, which is Eliasberg calculation, they find spin triplet F-wave because the presence of these pockets. And there is flex Eliasberg calculation, which shows it's either P-wave or F-wave. All these proposals actually take making use of these pockets. On the other hand, there is also a proposal for superconductivity using just a single band, following the idea of doped insulator for high TC. In that case, you get D plus ID state. So the presence or absence of these pockets is actually an important issue, fundamental issue to be addressed. So now we looked at the RPES of these materials. So there are two groups, one at Boston College, one at Princeton. And we have samples. Well, the samples that were studied come from three different sources, Oak Ridge and MIT and Princeton. And there are four publications. All points to one conclusion, that there is only a single hole Fermi surface around the gamma point that is observable in this entire range of doping that has been studied from 0.3 to about 0.75. Now I have to say this is down on the unhydrated sample, in some sense the parent compound of this material. Now if you look at the area of the Fermi surface, it actually satisfies the Luttinger count. So essentially it exhausts the number of carriers. Now even better than that, or worse than this, is you're not observing these pockets, but you do see the bands that is associated with the EG prime associated with this pocket. It just never, so the red line here is the LDA calculation, and you see these bands just never come up enough to the Fermi level. So it stays below the Fermi level.
Do you have any effects that you showed earlier for the hydrated or for the unhydrated?
It's for the unhydrated.
They did,
well, there are calculations for the hydrated one, which is just by expanding the C-axis, and the effect is quite minor. Yeah.
It looks like, is there anything crossing the
Fermi? Oh, this, yeah, this is just one intensity plot. This will cross, eventually this will cross Fermi level, but this one will stay here.
Is the AD band still so wide as expected from LDA?
RDA, yeah, the A1G band. A1G band is perfect, yeah, it's perfect here. So what you see beyond the absence of these pockets is the band narrowing. So the 1.6 volt from LDA becomes something like 0.8 volts, just about a factor of 2 band narrowing going on. And you might wonder whether this is just due to the surface effects. So they did some bulk X-ray photo emission, which has very low resolution but can go and go inside the bulk of the sample. And essentially you get the same results. You don't see those pockets.
Why
once again, the frame surface has considerable nesting.
Very good. Yeah, very good comment. Here it's at point.
If I recall properly, neutrons, people have said that they never see any intensity corresponding
yeah.
to these nesting vectors.
Exactly. All the neutrons have been down here because of material reasons. And the Fermi surface becomes rounded out here. It really becomes hexagonal as you get to one-third, close to the superconducting composition.
And there is no INS on those samples?
No. No, it's, yeah. So this discrepancy, I would say, it's a very clear-cut discrepancy between RPES and LDA, really points towards maybe electronic correlation is playing an important role. Okay, so what we want to do is try to study these electronic correlations on the T2G complex. And the idea we have is very simple. You take a Hamiltonian which has a non-interacting part and an interacting part, and you do the best you can with the non-interacting part to match the LDA band structure. And then you ask what are the effects of these interactions. The non-interacting part, which I'll come to in a minute, is very trivial. The interacting part is also written down in the literature. In fact, I tried to go back to the first group that have studied this Hamiltonian. It turns out to be a Claudio Castagnani and company in 1978 when they studied the magnetic structure of V203, which is also a triangular lattice with the T2G complex. So this is where this Hamiltonian came from. It's really very simple multiband Hamiltonian, Hubbert model. So it has an intraorbital U and an interorbital U prime that tells you double occupancy will pay energy. And it has a Hund's rule coupling, interorbital Hund's rule coupling. And the U and U prime are related this way, and the energy hierarchy is U is largest, U prime is smaller, and then Hund's rule is even smaller, and they're all greater than zero. So let me now briefly go through what we do with the non-interacting part, which is a very interesting exercise. I've never done this before, try to model LDA with a tight bending model for three bands on the triangular lattice. It turns out to be quite fun. So this is in the hole picture. We have one minus x holes. These d's are the 3d orbitals. We're going to forget about oxygen since they do not contribute to direct exchange. And we'll keep the hexagonal symmetry by all these three orbitals, keeping them degenerate. And this delta here is the trigonal crystal field that will split these degenerate levels. Okay, and you can momentum Fourier transform in momentum space. Now, how do you deal with three bands? That's a 3x3 matrix, right, which describes intraorbital dispersion and interorbital hopping causing dispersion. Okay. And each of this dispersion, you can write it down on the triangular lattice. You can go to as many neighbors as you like. All that you do is do the cyclic permutations, and you get the hopping matrix. Before I show the mapping to the LDA, I'll do one more thing to make the language easier, is I'll rotate from these D's to these A bases. Okay, later on, we'll only be talking in terms of A bases. That's just a simple orthogonal rotation. After you've done that, the good thing is the crystal field splitting becomes diagonal. So here is the EG prime orbital, here is the A1G. Notice this is in the whole picture. So now EG prime is lower. So this is really surprising. The EG prime orbital actually has a lower energy for holes. And in fact, holes should prefer to go to EG prime. But in reality, you don't see the pockets coming out of the EG prime. Right. And the interaction part is basis independent. I think this is the miracle of this Hamiltonian on the triangular lattice. So now this is the fit to the tight band, to the LDA calculation, which is the black here. As you can see here, anything above third neighbor hopping here, the blue is third, red is fifth, green is eighth. Anything above third neighbor hopping fits the low energy part quite well. But all of them will fill around here, where the LDA shows non-crossing bands, and this tight banding fit will give you a band crossing. And the reason for that is we have ignored oxygen. If oxygen is present, then the z-direction reflection symmetry is broken because of the octahedral tilt. So that will resolve this problem. But we'll, to simplify the analysis, we'll just use a third neighbor tie bending parameter. And the Fermi surface, the fitted Fermi surface is here, the blue one. So these are the parameters, which is not really important. And there is a crystal field splitting of about 10 mEV. So what I'm going to say later will not be affected by these parameters as long as you have the right parameters that give a good fit to the LDA. That's the only constraint. So let's look at the electronic correlation part and ask the question, can correlation induce carrier transfer and orbital polarization? And can correlation give band narrowing? Now, this problem is, of course, quite difficult because the interesting correlated problem is always in this intermediate region between itinerant and localized approaches. So what I would describe is a LDA plus Hartree-Fock calculation and an LDA plus Kurzweiler calculation from this side, and we'll see the results for both. And you can see the orbital carrier transfer quite easily in the Hartree-Fock approach. So the Hamiltonian in the Hartree-Fock approximation becomes something like this. And you need to pay attention just to the first term. Essentially, this term is gone because we're in this A1G basis. The density is diagonal. So this term, first term, tells you that if the carrier, since the carrier is essentially sitting in the initial condition in the A1G orbital, so if U is less than, if U prime is very small, then the tendency is to occupy the EG prime band, to occupy multi-orbital. Because U prime is small, so I can occupy multi-orbitals and reduce the double occupation energy cost. But this trend will have to stop at some point when U and U prime become comparable and they're all large, then they'll just stop double occupation. So all this can be actually calculated quite easily in terms of the Hartree-Fock self-energy for the A1G band and AG prime band. Now, I'll take a difference of these two energies. And this is the band center separation in Hartree-Fock approximation. And precisely, you see this dependence. The charge transfer direction is determined by the sign of this effective band center separation. And that has a critical value of U prime over U of 3 over 5. Right? So you see, as a function of U prime over U, you have different behavior. If U over U prime is less than 3 over 5, this separation is renormalized upward, and you see actually holes move out of the A1G into the EG prime. This is exactly what you would anticipate physically, right? Because U prime is smaller, the carriers would like to occupy multi-bands locally to reduce that energy. That's the blue. If U prime over U is 3 over 5, that is, it's exactly at this critical value, then there is no change. Hartree-Fock, the LDA plus U calculation give you the same answer as the LDA. That's the red. And on the other hand, if U prime over U is greater than 3 over 5, that means both U and U prime are large. So in this case, the system just has to reverse the trend, and the host will now move out of the EG prime to A1G. And this is when the pockets begin to shrink and eventually disappear. So even Hartree-Fock theory will give us the disappearance of the pocket. And just to show Hartree-Fock works very well, this is a very sophisticated U equals to 2 EV DMFT, dynamical mean field theory calculation, and then indeed find the pocket actually grows bigger than the LDA prediction for that size of U. And really, in order to observe the orbital polarization or the sinking pocket phenomena here, we need strong correlation. You can say that Hartree-Fock is doing its job, but it has problems because at this large U, it becomes unreliable. No electrons are stupid enough, in some sense, to pay a self-energy on the order of U as that given in Hartree-Fock. This is, you see, the bandwidth becomes so much larger when U becomes larger. Right? In fact, the bandwidth starts growing, and that is certainly inconsistent with the experiment. So 5 minutes, okay, so I'll just wrap up in 5 minutes, just talk about the strong coupling approach. So why don't we look at the physics from the very large U site, and this is exactly the opposite of the magnetites. You can send u and u prime to infinity and ignore the Holmes rule coupling. Right? And that all that says is you have no double occupancy. And that you can take care of this constraint by doing a Gutzwiller projection, that is to take the LDOA wave function and remove all the doubly occupied site. And usually the easiest way to do that is to do a Gutzwiller approximation. And in this case, we need to generalize that Gutzwiller approach to multi-orbitals. That's all that we need to do. We have well-defined, well-developed machinery to do that. Then the hopping is renormalized by this parameter, Gutzwiller parameter, which depends on the band index. And it's given by the probability of hopping in the projected state versus the unprojected state. Now, if I write this down, you can write this down by calculating this probability ratio. It's the doping x over something that depends on the density of the orbitals that are connected by hopping. Right? And this is usually termed as the Coulomb blocking effect, that is the strong correlation. The Mott physics is here. The denominator is here to compensate Pauli principle that is already working, that says two electrons of the same spin should not occupy the same site. So now this doping dependence is crucial for the orbital, this orbital dependence is crucial for driving the orbital polarization. So all that happens is you now use the orbital occupation as a variational parameter and minimize this Hamiltonian to get the best energy state. And this energy E alpha, this orbital dependent energy here, is determined self-consistently, which is the average kinetic energy given here. Right? So in this strong coupling approach, we don't have to pay energy U for the electrons. That's the merit of all these strong coupling approach. And what you see is very clearly charge transfer is now governed by two things. One is the renormalized level spacing, right? The center of gravity for the A1G band and EG prime band, which is given here. The other one is the band narrowing factor, which is given here. Now, I won't go to this detailed figure since I don't have time, but like I can summarize the effect as being the following. If you start with an orbital that has more hole occupation, then that orbital in strong coupling will have a smaller bandwidth reduction because this thing is proportional to that. That smaller bandwidth reduction combined with this band that started with more holes will have a lower band center. Right? So the combined effect is the charge will move. The more holes will move into that band. So this is why the holes will tend to move out of the EG prime band and into the A1G band. That's the strong coupling physics. Yeah.
So Mohit-Randeria and Nadine Kavedian have done comparisons of the Gutzwiller approximation with the numerical Gutzwiller projection.
Right, right.
And they find that on the square Hubbard lattice, that the Fermi velocity is unrenormalized as it changes the doping. And so the suggestion is that this GT renormalization may strongly be overestimating what's going on in terms of the kinetic energy part of their Hamiltonian.
Right. Right. No, but I would say it's much more complicated than that. What you when you do projection, real projection, right? You remove these doubly occupied states, you create the incoherent part, and then the coherent part and incoherent part talk to each other. That's the reason for this not clear dependence of the doping dependence of the Fermi velocity. Right. It's more. How should I say it? It's more complicated than this simple case. For example, if you ask them to set exchange coupling to zero, right, there is exchange coupling that doesn't get renormalized. Right? Then the Fermi velocity at small doping is always of order J. It's never really XT. Right? So, yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, I think in the theory it's already a little bit complicated. The Fermi situation is even worse. What we do find quite clearly by our experiments is that there is an order of charge ordering in the system linked with the ordering of the sodium.
Sure. And yeah, but I'm staying away from 0.5. Right? There's no.
0.5. At any, all the concentration that you can study uh-huh. corresponds to a very well defined order of the sodium.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot move the sodium concentration homogeneously. Charges which are not safe. That is, you cannot consider.
I'll come to that.
Not the uniform system.
Yeah, I'll come to that. Right. So the approach that we want to use is we start with the electronic properties, then without considering the dopants. That's like the way we follow what we're doing high TC. And now we can, on top of that, consider the dopant effects and why at certain concentrations is more dramatic than another concentration. So let me just show you the strong coupling result. Indeed, that you get tremendous bandwidth renormalization, about factor of 2. And the blue is LDA, the red is the strong coupling result. And the EG prime band is pushed down below the Fermi level, so the Fermi surface pocket is never there. And this is the actual Fermi surface, the red one. So since I see the chairman is already standing up, let me just come to this conclusion. In fact, just to address this issue of nesting. So forget about all these other things. Let me just point out to one thing that probably has something to do with inhomogeneity, the topic of this conference, is both the experiment and the calculation show when you're at 1/3 lower doping, the Fermi surface becomes hexagonal. Now, it's more interesting than that. If you look at this Fermi surface, nested Fermi surface, it actually coincides with the zone boundary if you had a square root of 3 by square root of 3 order. If you have a square root of 3 charge order on the triangular lattice, then you have to fold everything, right? If you fold everything, your zone boundary exactly matches this Fermi surface, nested Fermi surface. So what will happen, we have some evidence for that, is if you now allow inhomogeneous solutions, this nesting will drive the system into a charged water state by opening up gaps here, so gain a lot of energy. And there was an interesting proposal for this charge disproportionation forming a square root 3 by square root 3 charged water, which is very interesting, which turns the triangular lattice, in fact, into a honeycomb lattice. In that case, the spins can order, can new order. So you delete, so this side would be the 3+, and this would be 4+. And this state might be the starting point of an antiferromagnetic Mott insulator at 1/3, or close to 1/3. Okay, everyone know?
The experiments, the situation is exactly the reverse.
Mm-hmm.
1/3,
yeah.
There is no indication for charge disproportionation.
Okay, it's good.
Single side.
Okay.
Really uniform in that case, and there is a single side. That's true both for superconductor and non-superconductor.
Okay, yeah.
This kind of proportionation we find rather we find it as well as 2/3.
It can't be this kind. This kind would only exist at 1/3. It's a different kind, yeah. Yeah. So this is just interesting possibility. What I really think is close to this nesting vectors will enhance spin fluctuations, which will mediate the F wave superconductivity.
Okay. In fact, yeah. To respond to this question of nesting, we show that in the 1/2 phase,
yeah.
We have an antiferromagnetic charge density wave instability at 80 k.
Yeah. Yeah.
One G2 magnetism, and we have shown quite clearly that this phase is magnetic, and you have a second instability.
Well, you can't, there's no magnetic water, right? There's no.
No,
at 1/2?
No.
I thought, no, the neutron didn't see any.
I think you know too much neutron data, not enough NMR and USB.
Well, I know whatever data is published that you just. Yeah? It's published? Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay. We should talk about that. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Definition of really published. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. You guys will have
to. Yeah, we'll have to talk and sort it out. Yeah.
Okay, let's take the speaker.
The title, the Kondo effect in spin liquids. Let's write it down here.
Okay, the next speaker, Matthias Wortel, the Kondo effect in spin liquids.
Kondo. There you go. Okay, so I have the unfortunate task to entertain you while you are so hungry that you are all likely to run off for lunch. But nevertheless, I will try to restrict myself to get the main message across. And the main message is connected with the philosophy which we already heard about yesterday, namely that impurities can be very useful probes of interesting complex correlated systems, in the sense that by studying the response of dilute impurities in a system, you can have a handle on studying the elementary excitations of the system where we have the impurities planted into. So the Kondo effect is, of course, something which we very well know. And since this will be important for what comes later on, I will just start with wrapping up in like 3 minutes the basic things which we know about the Kondo effect in metals, and then come to the stuff which I really am heading for, namely the Kondo effect in spin systems, in particular exotic spin liquids. So the Kondo effect is about the physics of magnetic impurities implanted into something. And the first case, again, which is known as the fermionic Kondo effect, is when you couple a magnetic impurity, and since my time is limited, I have to use some abbreviations here, a magnetic impurity to fermionic quasi-particles. And these will be fermionic quasi-particles as you have them in any nice Landau Fermi liquid. And here we know that, provided that we start from a Hamiltonian, and now I'm just writing down the impurity part of the Hamiltonian, where you have some impurity spin. And in the following, I will restrict myself exclusively to spin 1/2 impurities. And where you couple this to the local spin density of this fermionic system, and so let's write it like this, that we have here spin density. The taus are supposed to be Pauli matrices. And then I will write it like this. Summation is implicit, and all this lives on the side R equals 0, where the impurity is coupled to. That's the usual Kondo Hamiltonian, and the C's are now conduction electrons. Then we know that here we always have Kondo screening at sufficiently low temperatures, in the sense that the spin degree of freedom of the impurity is quenched. So if you let's put a small a here in a metal, that's not important. The density of states at the Fermi surface is finite. So we have a density of states which is essentially constant near the Fermi level. And if this is so, then, as I said, the impurity is quenched at low temperatures. If you want to draw a phase diagram, then you would draw something where here is temperature, and here is the Kondo coupling. And then we know that the Kondo temperature depends exponentially on the coupling, so you would have a crossover line which has an exponential suppression at low J, and then you would find something which roughly looks like this. This you would call TK. And here the impurity is screened, and here the impurity is unscreened. And if you want to associate something with these words, then you can, for instance, look at the impurity part of the magnetic susceptibility, and which means here in the unscreened regime, T times chi imp is essentially just the free Curie law, so S times S plus 1 over 3, whereas here the T times chi imp is constant. No, sorry, the T times chi imp is 0. That is correct. The chi imp goes to a constant, T times chi imp is 0. So here, that's just the Curie constant, essentially. But that's what we all know. Now you can actually